Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. It's over 70 years since the start of World War II. And while we all know something about the horrors of that war, it seems that recently more attention is being paid to some of the horrors of the peace that followed. Why now? Does having a clearer picture of how bad things were change the lessons we learned about rebuilding societies after utter devastation? Sadly, something we still need to do, even if on a less global scale. Did you hear the news yesterday that a new study estimates that 500,000 people may have died in the Iraq War? Ian Baruma's new book is Year Zero, A History of 1945, and he looks at what happened in that first year after the end of the war, not just in Europe and Asia where the battles were fought, but in the developing world where colonial power was shifting. Welcome back to WNYC, Ian Baruma.
Thank you very much.
As has been pointed out, you're unusually qualified to write a history like this. To start with, your father was sent from Holland to do forced factory labor in Germany. I know you've lived in and written about Asia and Japan in particular, and now you're living here teaching at Bard College up the river. How many languages do you speak?
Well, I speak a lot of languages badly. I speak three reasonably well and three like an old traveling salesman.
So you're interested in traveling from culture to culture through the languages they speak as well as physically. And so tell us a little bit about your father's experiences and what he told you about the war when you were growing up.
Well, that was really that gave me the seed of an idea for this book. My father was a student in 1941 in the Netherlands. He was a law student, and he wanted to be a member of the fraternity. The fraternities were banned at the time because the Germans were afraid that there would be sources of resistance. And so, but it went on for another year at least. And that meant that the initiation ceremony, which included a lot of hazing and bullying and humiliation, had to go on underground, as it were. After that, my father was in Berlin, and he lived through the Battle of Berlin, was bombed, was almost shot, collapsed in exhaustion and hunger and so on, got back to Holland after all that, only to be told by senior students of his fraternity that the initiation, the humiliation, jumping around like a frog and so on, had to be done again because it hadn't been done properly the first time. And so I was astonished by that, that not just my father, but boys who'd been in very bad concentration camps had to take part in this humiliating childishness. And I gathered in the end that it was really because to them it represented normality, and an awful lot of people, not all, but a lot of people wanted to go back to the way things had been.
And so to write this book, you drew obviously not only on your own father's story, but on the letters, diaries, and novels of contemporary writers, as well as scholarly works. Can you give us some of the scope, the number of displaced persons, the level of hunger, of people who died after the war was over?
Well, a lot of people died because people didn't know, have enough experience to know how to cope with starvation. So people died in concentration camps who'd been starved because they were given army rations, Spam, and that kind of thing. I can't think of conjure the figures off the top of my head, but there were millions and millions and millions of people displaced. No place to go, no home to go back to, no country often to go back to.
And we took some notes. 8 million in Germany, 3 million in the rest of Europe. This is just the dead. 6.5 million in Japan. Displaced people. 500,000 Koreans. So displacement after 1945.
Absolutely. And of course, it happens after every war. And one of the reasons, as you hinted in your introduction, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that we forget that we can send in troops and depose dictators and so on, but we don't always think of the consequences. And wars tear, like dictatorships themselves, but they tear societies apart. They create civil wars and massive displacement.
And there was a cliche for baby boom kids growing up that I'm sure parents today don't say to their kids, finish your dinner, children are starving in Europe. Well, they wouldn't say Europe anymore.
No.
But they did.
Yes, I'm sure they did. My father, oddly enough, I had the same kind of thing when I grew up in the 50s and 60s. It wasn't the war so much. It was the world crisis of 1929. My father always used to say, remember, we didn't have enough to eat and so on.
Where do you think the stories that we've been telling for 70 years differ most from what actually happened?
Well, I don't think in the last 70 years we've been paying a great deal of attention to what happened after the war. For example, the massive revenge taken against the German populations of Poland and Czechoslovakia, people whose families had lived there for centuries. They were expelled. It was a horrible instance of ethnic cleansing. And we forget that we never heard much about it because people didn't really feel very sorry for the Germans. And in Germany itself, liberal-minded historians shied away from that kind of story because it smacked of right-wing revanchism and so on. So I think it's a kind of odd pocket of ignorance that's now coming to light.
What kinds of ethnic cleansing? Certainly that term, I think, came into common usage in our media at the end of the Cold War in the former Yugoslavia. But that kind of thing was happening elsewhere in Europe after World War II?
Yes. I mean, the main instances really were in Poland and Czechoslovakia, a little bit in Hungary, Romania, where you had very mixed populations. Most of the Jews, who'd played a very significant role, of course, in urban life in these countries, largely German-speaking, if they were educated, Yiddish if they were not, they perished. So that was no longer something that needed to be they were gone. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Germans who'd also lived there for a long time, and it was felt by the Allied leaders as well that they could no longer live together with their former fellow countrymen, the Czechs and the Poles and so on. And so they were simply expelled, often under very brutal circumstances.
And the Allies went along with or accepted this sorting by ethnic group?
Yes, they did. I think partly it's very easy to condemn them now. I think it's partly because it was genuinely felt there was so much bad blood, these people couldn't live together anymore. There was also, much more than today, then a sense that nation states should be defined by more or less mono-ethnic populations. And something, of course, that the Germans encouraged.
Well, yeah, calling that ironic after defeating Hitler with his ethnic sorting, obviously, barely seems adequate.
Indeed. And in some ways, this finished the job that Hitler began.
And to be clear, in writing this account, you're certainly not trying to rewrite history and merely expose evil doings on the part of the Allies.
No, and because there's also a positive side. The Western Allies had learnt their lessons of World War I, when in 1918 Germany was punished rather than sort of helped back onto its feet, which created the climate from which Hitler and the Nazis emerged. So the occupations of Germany and Japan were relatively benign. And there was also a huge amount of idealism. Now we have to create a better world in which these kind of horrors won't occur again. And it was the beginning of the United Nations. It was a united Europe, more equality and so on. And so, it was the Allies had there was much to be said for them.
What about Nuremberg and the war crimes trials in Japan? I guess that's just one of many areas where ideals met political realities.
Yes. I mean, the question was what to do with the brutes. Churchill, as well as others such as George Kennan, believed it was best just to put them up against the wall and shoot them. That what they'd done was so far beyond anything that conventional laws or even war crime laws, Geneva Conventions and so on, could cover, that they felt having trials would kind of in some ways taint the legal process. Oddly enough, it was the Soviets who insisted on a trial because they were used to show trials. This was the way they did things in the Soviet Union. And in a way, Nuremberg and later Tokyo were show trials, but it was probably better to have them than not because they did try, not always successfully, but to make them relatively fair, and it was normative. Without those trials, probably the Germans themselves wouldn't have staged war crime trials later.
Do you think we're any better at imposing an international rule of law today than we were then?
Well, it looks pretty messy to me at the moment. Very few people really believe anymore in what the United Nations is doing. A lot of the idealism, which I suppose is to be expected, of the post-war period has dissipated. The idea that society should be more equal, social democracy, all these things more or less flown out the window.
But the UN, among other things, I think flowed from a need to settle the peace differently after World War II than after World War I, which was such a hash that it helped set up World War II.
Yes, that's right. And despite the often shambolic behavior of the UN, it's still a talking shop. It's still a place where often hostile members of hostile governments can actually talk to each other. So I think I wouldn't want to abolish it.
And in the developing world, not democratization after 1945, but more colonialism, like in the Philippines, where despite relying on rebel groups to fight the Japanese, MacArthur restored power to the landowners.
Yes, he did. But the Philippines is an odd case because unlike the Dutch or the French or the British, the Americans actually already before World War II wanted to give the Philippines independence. And it was those Filipino landowners who benefited from the U.S. That continued it. In places like Vietnam, Indochina, or Malaya, or the Dutch East Indies, or North Africa, the European powers simply wanted to restore the colonial situation as it had been before the war. And, of course, that was a total impossibility.
My guest, Ian Baruma, his new book, Year Zero, A History of 1945. I note that even the often coercive sex between U.S. troops and local women that's had some recent attention, coercive if for no other reason than the soldiers had food, the women did not in those situations. You call your first chapter Exaltation. There was a lot of sex happening everywhere as people came back to life in a way. But do you put the rape of German women by Russian troops in the title, in the chapter titled Revenge, and point out it was actively encouraged by Russian leadership to distinguish between the Russians and the Western allies?
In a way, yes, because I think that the Soviets, what the Soviets did was a form of orchestrated revolutionary violence. As you say, they did encourage troops to do their worst with the Germans, and that wasn't true on the Allied side. Of course, the fact that the Allied soldiers were attractive, they had uniforms, they had money, they had Hershey bars, they had silk stockings and so on, whereas the local women often didn't have much of anything, made it coercive in a sense, but there are an awful lot of women in newly liberated countries who threw themselves at soldiers as though they were rock stars of a later age. I mean, it was a sexual liberation for women as much as it was a military one. And local men, of course, did not always take kindly to this, especially when you had a lot of dancing places and so on, which were accessible to Allied soldiers and their local girlfriends, but not for the local boys.
You write about a link between post-war rebuilding and the European welfare state. Did people want protection from themselves?
No, I think what happened is that people felt, especially from the less privileged classes, felt that they'd sacrificed themselves. Many people had died. They'd fought for their countries and so on, and not to go back to the old order where they would be bossed around by the same upper classes, represented in the case of Britain very much by Winston Churchill himself. And so I think people wanted a more equitable world. The same was true in the United States. One of the sources that I used in my research was a U.S. Army magazine called Yank, written by GIs for GIs. The politics of Yank were sort of a little bit to the left of where the nation is today.
The EU itself won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for having kind of ended war on a continent that had fought and fought and fought for hundreds and hundreds of years. Does that relate to any of this?
Yes. I think one of the main reasons people did support European unity was that it was seen, and I think rightly, as a way that would guarantee that France and Germany in particular wouldn't go to war again. And it did serve that purpose. Nobody in their right minds rarely thinks that there's going to be another major war on the European continent. Now, because people are not frightened of it anymore, that also means that the kind of moral and idealistic basis for European unity has also faded.
Your book is called Year Zero, and Lara asks on our comments page, could Ian Buruma comment on Roberto Rossellini's film Germany Year Zero from 1948, and if that incredible film is the basis for the title of his book?
Yes, and it's a very good observation. It is, in a way. It was called, the German phrase at the time was Stunde Null, 0 hour. Of course, the assumption behind these phrases is that the world was just one big ruin and people could just start all over again as though starting from scratch on a blank page. This is never the case. History always haunts us. There is a lot of continuity and so on. But the film, that and also his other film, Rome Open City, made in the last year of the war in Italy, were a great inspiration.
So before you go, why did you want to write this book now?
Partly because ideas come, and I can't remember who said it, Bernard Shaw, I think, and if you don't grab them quickly, they'll fly away. And partly because we've had so many recent wars in which people blithely talked about using military force to bring democracy, freedom, topple dictators, and so on, without really thinking of what happens after wars. And so, in a way, the book is also a warning.
A warning for post-Afghanistan, post-Iraq, post-Arab Spring, anything
Syria,
you want to get particular?
Libya,
all
the list
of the
goes
above.
On.
Yeah. Ian Buruma's new book is Year Zero, A History of 1945. Thank you so much.
Thank you.